self-censorship, I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about how people who are coming of age, growing up, knowing social media, are less aware of the need to self-censor in those same, in many similar ways that people anywhere in the world will often just throw things out there. And what kinds of do we see a security services monitoring swooping in faster to rein them in, which I imagine would be quite a challenge despite the pervasiveness of the security services. And then the Cork Mamas question is, let's say I'm a State Department official, why should I care about a group of people living outside of Uzbekistan holding up signs all over the world? And then if I were a government, Uzbek government security service person, why would I be concerned about that? And would I be even more concerned if there were an Islamic overtones to such a campaign, which could happen in the future?
It already did.
Elaborate.
To answer the Islamic overtones part, I mean, it became really quickly a community where people could talk about anything, and wherever that happens, everywhere that happens, Hizbullah Tahrir finds it. And so, I mean, it's broader and it's changed. It's done a lot of different things, but I mean, that was one of the first things that these sort of, I guess we call them proselytizing groups, really, whether they're jihadist organizations or an Islamist organization like Hizb-ut Tahrir, they have a very savvy social media strategy, and every time they see something like this, they'll target not only the place, but they'll target the administrators as well, and they will they'll tag them in their posts so that they can sort of hijack that person's feed, either on Facebook or on Twitter. And so they leaked into that really quickly. I see, Sarah, I think people inside Uzbekistan participating in this as well, right? Would you characterize it as an external thing, or do you feel like it's a mix?
It's hard to tell because there's so many people involved, but yeah, it's a mix, and that's notable. Any space that manages to be integrated in that way is notable, because the goal of the government has been to keep those different groups of people from interacting. As for your other questions about self-censorship, part of the way people get their cues of what kind of content is permissible to post is just by observing other people. And so, if people are not seeing political messages or religious messages of a certain tone, they're going to emulate that. And they're also receiving very concrete advice, from the government and from people around them about what's good to post and like what kind of topics are permissible. And there are whole, social media networks that are devised to encourage Uzbeks to post about certain content. And I think that, for a younger generation that's used to the internet, that's always grown up with the internet, they might not be told explicitly to self-censor, but when laws are being passed, to this year, like the blogging law that I mentioned, but also a law that all internet cafes have to be monitored, they can't be in basements, all the people who use them will be recorded, all the URLs that are being used are going to be reported back to the government. I mean, that sends like a real message of you better be careful what you post. And so I think the combination of encouraging certain type of content and then a general wariness of don't post things that are untrue, which is a very vague request that could easily be manipulated in order to arrest somebody under the pretext of this is untrue. Like, that people aren't foolish, they're afraid and they don't want to be in trouble, and I think they want to use the internet for their enjoyment, and they don't want to have to deal with law enforcement officials as part of that experience.
We have another eager question back here.
First, couple of questions and comments. The first one is to Del. analyzing the Islamic internet pertinent to Tajikistan, I have came to a conclusion that it's mainly looks at the questions of orthodoxy. And now, you know, looking at Kazakhstan, you gave, you know, a very different idea that it's basically trying to get some sort of advantage in the marketplace of this lifestyles, basically. Why is it only, you know, economic differences or other things at play, or just the diversity of all of this? Second comment is, I don't know, any of you maybe could respond to it, is regarding the demography of the audience, and then, you know, more broadly the penetration of the internet as such in the context that you have looked at. Because in Tajikistan, when we look, you know, well, first of all, there is not great internet penetration, and then secondly, the usage itself is very specific. So whenever you talk to, whenever we talk to our peers back at home, and we say, "Oh, have you seen this on YouTube?" and they're like, "Oh, we never use YouTube because you actually have to pay for it," and they use this provider provided content that is free. So there's things like TouchTube because local traffic, they don't pay for the local traffic, and they actually watch a lot of movies, pirated movies. That's one. That's, you know, one remark. Another one is, I think, Noah, you said that they address, you know, issues about everyday Islam, right? Well, the logical question is, why would they not address their own local imams, so go to them with those issues? Because, you know, they're quite basic, they're not political in nature, those questions. And then one final one is something that came up in the morning with my husband is we noticed or just remarked that post-Soviet space, humor is very politicized, and in the context of Tajikistan, especially, you know, regarding with this religious related issues, it has been actually used as a tool to avoid some of these issues concerned with censorship. So, you know, without having actually going into self-censorship, you know what I mean? So, and your humor and sarcasm, and to what extent you're seeing that happening.
So I'll go first. I mean, when you say orthodoxy, you're talking about defining correct practice or belief then? So a lot of the what you're saying... Yes. So a lot of that comes from, I mean, first off, that's addressing basic things that are expected of, that most Muslims know, right? I mean, especially if you're outside of the former Soviet Union, and this is different in different parts of Central Asia. But I mean, if you're in Turkey, I've talked with Turkish friends, and like, my dad taught me how to pray when I was five, and I don't pray at all, but I at least know how to. Many Kazakhs, I have no idea how to pray. I never got taught when I was five. They've got no clue, right? So there is that very basic. Here's what, how to pray the five namaz. Here's how to fast. Here's when you should fast. But there's also. And that's a very Soviet top-down, this is Islam, it's the five pillars, here you go. There's also the idea that in Kazakhstan, people are, at least imams and Asal Arna and all these other people, are a bit more media savvy, and they know that there's more to Islam than simply defining correct practice, right? So they're telling you how Muslims, what a Muslim life could look like. Because a lot of people say, oh, if you're in Kazakhstan, oh, if you're a Kazakh, if you're a Muslim, you're going to live a very boring life. You can't drink, you can't do this or this. And so they're trying to show what an actual Muslim life can look like. And that's why they take a lot of, I can't remember the U.S. website. There's a U.S. website that the Central Mosque in Astana translates a lot of stuff from, saying, this is how you interact with your friend who drinks, or this is how you do this. I mean, it's a much more open media environment, and it's more media savvy people, I think. And then there's lots of other questions.
Sarah, do you want to do the demographic one? I think about, you were asking about internet penetration and what demographics use the internet.
Yeah, it's hard to really know the internet penetration rates for Uzbekistan because they're reported by the state. And, you know, Uzbekistan, just like Azerbaijan and a lot of other states, likes to promote itself as a very tech-savvy, you know, internet using kind of place. I think that the last estimate was something like 30% of users. You know, one thing that has changed that we do know for sure is cell phone penetration rate, mm-hmm. which is extremely high. And so a lot of Uzbeks are getting their information through cell phone use, you know, and I think as in most countries, the demographic is, you know, younger people. That's significant for Uzbekistan because about half of the population is under 25 years old. And so you really have the majority of Uzbek citizens are people who have, you know, one, grown up in an independent Uzbekistan with no memory of, you know, Soviet times and with one ruler their entire life, and also have grown up basically with the internet. I mean, internet use wasn't really prevalent until about, I don't know, like 7 years ago or so. It's really grown exponentially every year. But, you know, we're dealing with a new group of people, you know, a younger group of people who are more technologically savvy than before. And I guess the other thing to add is that, you know, as in most other countries, they tend to be centered more in urban areas versus rural areas, but that's where the cell phone use comes into play.
And that's another, the migrant labor is another big part of that. I mean, a lot of that goes too to your question about why are people asking these questions on the internet instead of asking their local imam. I mean, in Uzbekistan, that comes into play because they are, in many cases, phasing out question and answer time after sermons. And this is one of the big things in the 80s and 90s as part of the Islamic revival in Uzbekistan. They've decided this is too dangerous, and we're not going to allow this. There are, if you read, the Uzbekistan publishes all the sermons on the Mufti website, and so you can read in some of them. At the end, there are specific instructions to the imams to remember not to take any questions after the sermon and be sure to disperse people as quickly as possible because it's Friday and they're supposed to be working and they shouldn't linger in the mosque. No, this is a... So this is another reason why the internet is good. But this, especially for the millions of migrant laborers who may not have access anywhere near them, you know, in Novosibirsk or Chelyabinsk or somewhere like this, where they don't have an Uzbek-speaking imam within hundreds of miles for them, the internet is a huge resource, or even ones who are living in the Middle East and they don't speak Arabic. You know, they have all of these incredible Islamic resources around them, but they lack the language skills, at least at first, in order to be able to use any of them. And so there are lots of the first... lots of the earlier Islamic reference websites were Uzbeks living in the Middle East who were translating content and making it available to other people living abroad or people back at home. There was another question about humor as a way to get around. Bexo, do you want to take that one? This is a very culturally nuanced question.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. Sometimes they can talk about certain issues in a direct way, and they use humor. And there are a lot of anecdotes that they spread even on the internet, and people know what it's about. Maybe non-native speakers may not understand it well, but yeah, this is another case. And I had one comment about how the government is going after monitoring the internet and the people how that are of some critical views. I think there is a law that requires every single website to register with the government if it is of some news writing website like of informational type as a news media outlet, but I think the government has not allocated enough resources to enforce it fully, because we see, I think most of the websites are not registered yet according to the law. And this is another reason why they don't, I mean, there are some people who are openly like expressing their critical views inside the country, and the government is not, I don't think it's really behind every suspicious person. They don't have enough maybe resources to do that. On the other hand, if you look at the like print media or the TV and radio stations, they are 100% under strict control, because they are the main traditional means to reach the population inside the country. There's no exception for independence, or there is definitely self-censorship in these outlets.
Thank you. Yeah, so just about kind of comments and addings to Del's presentation. I mean, Kazakhstan is look kind of like, yeah, it's free, internet is available, each like even in small towns you have this mall, so it's free of Wi-Fi, cafeterias, but as internet providers are under control. So we have like several companies like Megaline, like Kazakh Telecom, which, I mean, under control of state, and websites can be easily blocked. I mean, of course, if you are smart enough, you can use and open, but still it is kind of control is going on. Also about like Noah's question about like how internet help SNDC like become, how internet like made the sources available. Actually, what I saw in the last couple of years is kind of like, I don't know, like gadget Apple revolution is going on in Central Asia, and all these gadgets, smartphones, iPhones, iPads actually become very accessible and actually easy to buy. For example, this summer in remote village, I saw like a van, it's like a kind of U-Haul style van came to this village with the logo of big company like Technodome, Techno House. And they sold this their stuff from this van to villagers, and like it was like a talk. Okay, I will give you this iPod, and yeah, I will return money on autumn when I will slaughter my cow and I will sell meat. So and you will come on like by the end of fall and take money. That's really what's going on. I mean, and if you will see, not only like people in cities got access, and I mean all this technical revolution and which made. Which allow people to download materials, to download like hadiths, Quran verses for free. You're just paying like $40-$50 for internet per month. And I remember like in 2004, 2005, people used it was circulation of Xerox copies, CD drives, and like people used like phones with Bluetooth to deliver like a video or a lecture, etc. So definitely internet made kind of accessory. Yeah. So, but also what is interesting is that Asalarna also have a TV channel called Asalarna. But as I said, Asalarna is under control too. I mean, state controls. I mean, you cannot talk about Kazakhstani politics. You can, for example, talk about Muslim conflict in Kashmir, war in Chechnya. You can, for example, put videos how Muslims were massacred somewhere in other part of the world. But you cannot touch... prohibited, definitely. The journalism is prohibited to talk. You cannot talk about, like... So it's kind of like, I don't know, Foucault's idea of biopower. State is not there, but it's kind of... control into. So you're talking about how to be pious and a lot many other things, but you cannot tell that life is bad or we should unite against Nazarbayev or something like this. It's totally, but you can talk about, like as I said, about foreign use, what's going in another part of Islamic world. I mean, and it's okay. Yeah.
So I was just going to say in response to that, that of course, I mean, it's the official Islamic television station, right? But at the same time, and yes, there are certain topics that they don't address. People don't go to them for that, though, right? I mean, I'm just not sure how much people are looking to Asalarna or other Islamic leaders for news on Zhang Uzun. They're not. I don't think they are, right? They go there because they want to know the six reasons that you don't drink, or... what would be the best way to break your fast, or an amusing anecdote about something, right? They don't go there, at least in Kazakhstan. And this is where that sort of cultural and political specificity comes in. I don't think they go there for political news in Kazakhstan. I think they go there for different reasons, if that makes sense.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about your methodology, like what websites you decide to follow? And I've heard a lot about Facebook, but not a lot about Anna Klosnicki, which I think is critical. If you follow that, and if you follow groups within those mediums, if Anna Klosnicki and Facebook. And then also, to Shakhnoz, I wanted to say, I think YouTube is just blocked most of the time in Tajikistan, and that's why people don't watch it. It's free there. It's just blocked all the time. But if you could talk about your methodology and how many websites you do follow and what you decide to follow, especially Russian Islamic websites coming from Russia.
No.
You don't?
Give it to an anthropologist.
No.
Okay. Well, I mean, our methodology for this project is ethnographic. Most of us have an anthropology background. So rather than doing the big quantitative data harvesting and things like that, what we do is look at the sources that people actually use and the way that they talk about it and look for the places where they talk. So the things vary a little bit, but what you look for, it's just kind of mix to sort of mix methodologies here. You look for key nodes in the networks. So, like if you're working on Facebook, you try to after a long period of observation and a lot of interviews with people who actually use these sites, you use kind of both a mix of quantitative and ethnographic methods to identify key nodes in the thing, and then follow the conversations and discussions as they go from there. And then eventually that leads you to some kind of key media sites or key groups, or you follow people and sort of watch what they do every day and their online habits and where they get information from, and watch as they talk about it with one another, what is it that they do. I mean, and so there's a little bit of a mix, again, of some basic quantitative stuff where you can see numbers and you can see how influence is reflected that way just by literally the number of followers or friends that a person has, the number of likes and shares and retweets that they get and something like that, this sort of basic social media analysis work. But then that doesn't always tell you the truth, right? I mean, there are all kinds of ways to game that. And the Central Asian governments aren't quite as good at that as Russia is in some of the Caucasus countries. For example, Azerbaijan just did a campaign recently, but this is not my own work, but Azerbaijan just did a campaign a week or 2 weeks ago where they've figured out how to hire Twitter bots and stack them up in TweetDeck and make it look like there are hundreds and hundreds of people saying one particular message, when in reality there's one kid who gets paid $5 an hour, you know, in some office in a nationalist political party to hit this over and over. Russia perfected this long ago. I mean, theirs is super organized this way. The Central Asian governments have been a lot slower to come to that. Groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir and some of the VEO, the violent extremist organizations that I'll talk about in the next talk, also are pretty good at that. They're much more savvy at that. And so there is certainly some analysis that has to go into it there, where as people are attempting to look more influential than they actually are, you know, how do we distinguish between people who really have a following and those who are influential and those who just are really good at gaming the numbers and making it look like they do.
So in Anna Klosnicki, you can have a group and it'll be about Islam, but it seems like there's Russian influence in their gaming the system. And you can see that trying to draw people away just to see who will go, or what Thomas Sankaran call imposters. So can you see that in the they might be what would you call imposters that aren't really.
This is for Sarah, really.
I was going
to
say.
I mean, one thing, you know, to take into account is that we've been following these groups for like about a decade. And so, you know, familiar faces and people will show up again and again. And we also, you know, networks of trust or distrust emerge around certain individuals. And so that's just something that we take into account when analyzing, you know, how networks form is just the broader historical scope of it. And it, you know, becomes easier to pick out if somebody is a, you know, a bot versus a human, you know, because we've interacted with them or we've watched, you know, other online interactions.
I was also going to say that, I mean, like ethnography anyway, there's nothing wrong with a directed sample, right? I mean, you don't need a random sample of everything. If you're going to go talk about shrines in Uzbekistan, you don't visit every one. You tend to hang out at one or two for a year, right? Same thing goes with websites. If I want to know what's going on with Asalarna, I sit there and that's my directed sample. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's what everyone does, but at least we know something about something.
There is a there are imposters, and there are security service accounts, and there are jihadist imposters, and there's a great amount of distrust that develops between that. And Sarah has an article about that, so that was what I was thinking of in mentioning her. Do you want to talk a little bit about the
are you referring to?
It's just in general, like let's see, in the. So earlier in the year, at one point this year, you were telling me about SNB profiles that were set up on Facebook, right? That were trying to pull information out from people. You were contacted by one of them, right?
That was on Twitter.
On Twitter.
Yeah, you know, like underlying all of this is a, you know, an atmosphere of distrust that's different from the regular atmosphere of distrust that people face in Western countries, you know, because people are genuinely wondered if they're being surveilled by the state. You know, I've had people approach me online who I'm fairly confident were, you know, SNB people, you know, who knew a lot about me and were trying to extract information about others in kind of a, you know, ham-handed way. You know, the problem is that everybody who goes online kind of has this in the back of their mind, and that's really why, you know, like time is the cure to that, you know, like to test if somebody is trustworthy, to see if they're consistent in how they interact with others, you know. And I also agree with what Dell says, you know, you can never get, I think, on the internet a comprehensive scope. In the same way, if you go to a country, if you're doing anything ethnographic, you're not going to get something that represents the whole country. You'll get something that you can really understand a particular community or a particular dynamic, but there'll always be things that are left out of that equation.
You're absolutely right that YouTube is occasionally blocked in Tajikistan, but even when it's not, people do not prefer to use it as a source of, for example, viewing any sort of video, because TouchTube, the local intranet version of YouTube, video sharing is preferred because you actually do not have to pay for the traffic of it. So you can view it for hours and hours, and you don't have to pay. As opposed to YouTube, you would actually have to pay for the data. This is what I meant. That it's not like, yeah. Okay. So, clarify.
There's the hand up for a long time.
Hi, Shuluz Bayzakova, visiting scholar from Nice NDU. Thank you very much for your presentation. I have a couple of comments and a question for you. You mentioned that there's a lack of information available for Kazakh Muslims and general Central Asian Muslims in the internet. And I think that part of the reason is because actually you wouldn't find many serious traditional Kazakh Muslims using internet. Those Muslims are somewhere located in rural areas where there's no, for example, access to the internet. They go into and speak with the local imams. That's how they get the access to information, but usually the people that you see, as you call media savvy, who blogs, who has Twitter accounts or Facebook accounts, they all live in big cities, they're all very well educated. Yes, they do speak different languages, but it's a very small percentage of society strata that actually have access and then are really interested in finding out about the ways how traditional Islam work or try to convert themselves much. And for another comment is about the monitoring internet cafes. I forgot which country was in one of the Central Asian countries that the law had been imposed that each cafe has to have logs for up to 3 months, to keep the logs up to 3 months, and there has been the owners of these cafes interviewed. So actually to implement it practically, they need terabytes of gigabytes and terabytes of the hardware space to keep that kind of information. And lots of those internet cafes are actually very modest, and most of them are like on the brink of extinction. They just can't afford buying such equipment, such hardware, and most of them basically, due to this law, are on the brink of shutdown, or most of them shut down. So it's not because they don't want to comply with the rules, because it's very expensive to keep these logs. Also, yeah, I wanted to agree with the person who said about Kazakh web internet providers, more state monitored, but the way they monitor is not like they kind of look at the key words or something. So, for example, I'm as a researcher try to access one Chechen website with some kind of radical information in it, and I received from my internet provider from Beeline, the page comes up saying that this website is blocked due to such and such rules according to the law, and it's not only as much as control, but I think what state is trying to do is trying to protect its citizens from receiving unwanted and the information that leads to radicalization efforts to extremism. So my question to the panel is, what do you think, how big you think there was an impact of social media to those Central Asian fighters that now went to fight in Syria, now they're fighting for Islamic State, because an authorized figure is that it's about 250 Central Asian fighters are now fighting for IS. And how much do you think social media impacted, or did they lure them, or did they recruit them to go there? What do you think about that? Thank you.
On that last question, there's a whole presentation on the next panel on that question, so we might save that for that one. Does anybody want to answer the other ones?
I guess part of it was directed at me. The internet, I mean, internet penetration in Kazakhstan is huge. I mean, Ulan was in the middle of nowhere. And people have iPhones there, right? Like, people have access to the internet in Kazakhstan now. That's just unavoidable. That's a fact. Secondly, who's interested in it? Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to say that everyone is looking at Islamic websites in Kazakhstan. There's a bunch of them. There's actually plenty of material for someone to go and look at if they want to. Some of them are fairly popular. Some of them are less popular. I mean, I don't really know. People look at them when they're interested in them. I don't really know what your question was. Okay, that was a comment, but I mean, people have the internet and they look at these websites when they're interested in Islam, just like people in America look at, I don't know, the 700 Club website when they're interested in that kind of religious ideology or religious practice or belief. There's different stratums, and this was just part of what's out there. But I would say that social media in Kazakhstan and maybe throughout Central Asia is quite, I mean, in Kazakhstan it's ubiquitous.
We're out of time, aren't we?
No. We got 4 minutes, we started by.
A few minutes more? Okay, we have a new question there.
Lilia Karimova, GW. From your presentation, it sounded like people, Muslims who are interested in becoming practicing or have stepped on the path to piety, you know, internet is ubiquitous, it's easily available, so when they need to learn something, when they want to receive Islamic knowledge, they go to either certain websites or they can even get information from social media news feeds. But it seems to me that that ought to change the relationship of the very the nature of the very faith and practice and perhaps the community. Because it's one thing if you go to a local imam and ask questions, you establish a relationship with them and you become accountable to them and to the local community. It's another thing if you go to a website, it's unidirectional more or less, unless you participate in forums and you kind of figure out who is who. But still, it's much easier to change your identity, to change your practice, to change your affiliation, to go to another site. So there is no, to me it sounds like that has to change the very nature of the belief, the practice, and the local community. Have you observed those effects of social media, both the websites, of the internet, both the websites and social media on the people themselves and their everyday lives? And how they practice their faith, and how the communities are formed.
Begzo, do you want to comment on this one?
Yeah, I think you are right. The internet changed the way Muslims receive knowledge and learn about their religion. Traditionally, people used to get their knowledge through scholars sitting face to face. And there is even a famous hadith which states, "Whoever receives his knowledge." Whoever does not receive his knowledge from a teacher, then his teacher is a Satan or Shaitan. This was the emphasis put on the teacher should have an authority and there should be an unbroken chain between the teacher and his teachers. This changed with the use of social media and the internet. Now everyone who has access to the internet and knows maybe other languages has a huge resources available, and many scholars see it as a negative trend, and they warn Muslims not to be too, like, be involved or heavily rely on the sources on the internet. And this also led to further division among the Muslims, even among the people from the same place, like, of various religious groups, like Salafi, Sunni, that those who Sufis, there is a lot of debates going on the internet among the people who speak the same language, who are from the same region. And I have never seen an instance where, for example, Sufis and Salafis came to an agreement or accepted each other's views. This is a global trend, actually, among the Muslims.
I was also going to say that's not an internet thing. That's a mass media thing, right? You could read books, you could watch TV by yourself. That's not necessarily the internet. Internet, of course, the internet is part of it. But I mean, it was earlier than the internet. And I mean, Eichelman wrote about that with mass public education and print media, right? Then that's anyone can be an expert then, right? So I mean, yes, there's that. I also want to. You can get that knowledge, and it does change how you might interact with your imam or another community leader. But it also, I mean, it will change it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're less involved with the community, right? Just because a church has a website doesn't mean that people stop going to church. I mean, that's the sort of, whenever I hear Islam, I immediately say, does this make sense if we talk about Christianity in the same way? And people never do. So people will still go to church, right? They will still interact with the Pope or with their priest or minister. They just have another way of using that. And finally, it's not just knowledge, it's emotion and things. Like, knowledge makes religion cognitive, and it's not just that.
Okay, we're out of time for the panel. I know there's still a lot of questions, so please feel free to talk to the panelists afterwards, and just join me in thanking the panelists. for this great discussion.